Hello, you're listening to Sean from Galactic Chat, and today I'm interviewing Australian fantasy novelist Rowena Corey-Daniels. Welcome to the podcast, Rowena.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Now, I introduced you as an Australian fantasy novelist, but I feel that undersells you to some degree. You've had an association with Australian speculative fiction since about the mid-70s. Could you outline for our listeners your career and involvement to date?
When I was 18, I ran away to Melbourne with Paul Collins, and he started a small press publishing company, and I helped out on the side. And we had a book and record shop which specialised in science fiction and fantasy. Then I had a graphic arts studio for a few years. And then I had 6 children in 10 years. And then I got back to writing and I had 30 children's books published. And I sold the fantasy trilogy. And I was involved with Vision Writers setting that up and on the national committee for a couple of different art bodies, plus the state art bodies, plus more recently I sold the King Roland's Kin trilogy and I'm back into writing fantasy. Plus I've also sold, I call it my gritty crime noir, The Price of Fame, which has a dash of paranormal in it. So I'm really a bit of everything.
You released King Roland's Kin trilogy in 2010 and The Outcast Chronicles and The Price of Fame this year. That's
yes.
7 books over a 3-year period, not to mention teaching film studies and renovating.
Yes.
How did you do it?
Well, there was a big gap between my first trilogy, which came out 1999 to 2002, and then I was orphaned because the line I was published with was closed down and the editor moved away. And even though the omnibus of my first fantasy trilogy had sold out, the publishers didn't want to publish anything more that I wrote. So, as I said, I was orphaned, and that's a funny feeling for a writer. You keep writing anyway, so I just kept writing books and sometimes 2 or 3 books. Like when I sold the King Roland's Kin trilogy, I didn't realise that I'd almost finished the trilogy because I hadn't looked at it for a while. And then when I came back to it, it didn't take very long to put it all together, which is why Solaris released it a month apart. I really like it when they do that with trilogies. So, yes, I still have a backlog of books which I will get around to cleaning up and sending off.
You were quoted in Donna Marie Hansen's genre overview as, and I'm paraphrasing you here, choosing speculative fiction as it allows you to hold a mirror up to humanity's foibles. I can see this in your most recent trilogy. Would you care to elaborate on the particular foibles you're exploring in The Outcast Chronicles?
I think that's the power of fantasy. I think it's been used in science fiction a lot. People use the science fiction genre to say, where will we be in the future? But I don't think the fantasy genre has been used to its full potential. So what I tried to do with The Outcast Chronicles was take behaviours in society that trouble me, that's discrimination and persecution, and make them less familiar and confronting for the reader by transposing them to a fantasy setting so that you take away loaded nouns that we associate with different groups in this real world that we live in. And hopefully the reader identifies with the characters and experiences what they experience firsthand. It's reading a book, you're walking in someone else's shoes. So I was trying to explore discrimination and persecution in a fantasy setting. And I think it might have worked from the reaction I had from readers.
I certainly felt there were some quite obvious references to the persecution we see around us, particularly in relation to differences in appearance, difference in culture. But I was very interested, and it's only just occurred to me today because I read a report into the a real world report on the culture within the Australian Defence Force, which is a up until very recently a very male culture. And I picked up with your reference to the brotherhoods in the Outcast Chronicles, that looking at how it seemed to be in a lot of those brotherhood institutions, for want of a better word, that the institution was unhealthy. And I was wondering if that was another thing that you were looking at there, try to think of a word, but you know, the effect, the corrupting influence a bad institution or a bad culture within an institution can have.
Yes, that's a good point there, Sean. I base the brotherhoods on research that I've done into behaviour when men get grouped together into prisons or the army or the police force, and it seems to encourage some of the worst behaviour that you can come across. And one of the other things I tried to do with the Outcast Chronicles was to reverse the positions of power, because in the real world, women are most likely to be raped and murdered and children to be killed by the males in their lives. And it's always struck me that if women were more powerful than they are, would they put up with this going on? And so I created the sisterhoods, where it's certainly not perfect the way the mystics have set up their society, but they've done it for a reason. And it's been an attempt to isolate violence and protect the children. So I also felt when I was writing it that it might be confronting and uncomfortable for males because of the way the brotherhoods behaved. And I did have one reader contact me on Twitter. This is a female reader who complained because there were relationships of love and support within the female sisterhoods, but she felt that the brotherhoods were much more violent and there were much less incidences of supportive relationships within that, which I felt a bit bad about, because I don't think that men are all terrible. I'm married, I have a wonderful husband, and I've got four sons, and my brothers and my father are all very nice, very good men. So I didn't want to come across as being totally negative about men. But a book is meant to contain conflict, so I had to show bad things, otherwise you don't have, you haven't got the conflict for the story.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I'm a fairly mature reader, but I did find aspects of that of the portrayal of brotherhood culture uncomfortable. But it's only uncomfortable in the sense that I think that you are hitting the nail on the head with regard to some of, you know, I haven't been in the army or in a very sort of male-dominated institution, but I've certainly read things that would back up what you've portrayed there. So sort of following on from what you were saying there, both your recent trilogies contain takes on sexuality and gender that make readers uncomfortable. I'm personally okay with being made uncomfortable. That doesn't worry me. That adds, you know, you're getting something out of the book if that's happening. But aside from that one person that contacted you on Twitter, has there been any sort of, not complaints, but anything else voiced by your readership?
With the first trilogy, which had one lone gay character who was one of the major characters, I had someone on Amazon say that when they discovered that this particular character was gay, that they simply refused to read the book. So there was that element. And I had been expecting, with the release of the Outcast Chronicles, to get a backlash. And maybe it will happen, because sometimes things just fly under the radar. But as you said, I think sometimes you have to present the world in its full range of the good, the bad, the wonderful. And if you don't do that, you don't get the full depth colour to the story. and I'm not saying that being gay is good or bad or anything, it's just one of the aspects of humanity. And I also felt that with the Outcast Chronicles, it was a logical flow on from the way their society was structured. So if I hadn't had that form of relationship, it would have been writing in a way that was not true to human nature and portraying human nature.
I concur. I mean, of course, I love the book, so I'm not going to disagree with you, perhaps on anything. But I tend to think, if I didn't think at any stage when I was reading it, oh, you know, Rowena's pushing an agenda here. It felt uncomfortable, but it felt natural. And this leads to a point that I know you've talked about gender and the perception that fantasy, at least in the UK and the US, is a bit of a boys' club and perhaps a bit conservative. And I just wondered if, say, comparing your work with Game of Thrones, which is pretty much blokey, conservative, pseudo-medieval fantasy, do you think that the majority of fantasy is conservative? And that's a pretty much an umbrella word, but do you see fantasy as somewhat conservative?
I read an interesting article, and if I were writing this interview rather than speaking off the top of my head, I would go and Google it and find it and insert the link into my response, but I can't do that. It was analysing what they called a new wave of gritty writers in fantasy, and Joe Abercrombie was one of those people. And if you've read Joe Abercrombie's books, you would admit that they're very gritty. So I think that fantasy as a genre is growing and evolving. I had never seen fantasy as being blokey, because being an Australian, we have this wonderful depth of female fantasy authors here. And it wasn't until I was being interviewed by people in the UK and until I met several US-based female fantasy authors who were saying that it was blokey over there, and that female fantasy writers were not getting reviewed in as many places or promoted as much as the male writers were, that it occurred to me that it was different in other places. So that was why I started that series of interviews on my blog with what I call fantastic female fantasy authors, which is now morphed into fantastic, interesting people in specular fiction and covers men, women, comic artists, all sorts of people.
I was just wondering if you thought the fantasy genre as a whole, not only being blokey, because we've just discussed that, but is somewhat conservative in the sense that conservative traditional values, which I think your most recent trilogy sort of breaks away from in some regards, in terms of its focuses on gender and sexuality. So did you find the fantasy field conservative in that sense, and did you think it had changed at all?
I do think that it's changing and evolving. I do think that there will always be a section of the fantasy which produces what I call traditional, almost middle-of-the-road quest-type fantasies, because they are enduring, they are entertaining. But we can do so much more with fantasy as a genre. I was trying to push the boundaries of what you can do with fantasy as a genre when I wrote The Outcast Chronicles. And that particular trilogy has been 10 years in the making, dramatic music there, and had gone through several different incarnations, which my writing group have read and come back to me and said, Rowena, it's like reading a book about in a foreign language with subtitles and you still can't understand what it means, because I had immersed myself so deeply into the culture that I had created that I was in trouble communicating it to the reader, which is why I was so pleased when what I've done with these three books has been able to communicate the complexity of the invented culture, but also being able to keep in touch with the reader.
Okay. I often cite yourself and Marianne Dupierre as my role models for how to behave and build community within Australian speculative fiction. What drives you to be so open and community-minded in a world where there is conceivably so much competition in the form of widespread competent writing?
That's a good question, Sean. I think it comes from being a parent. It comes from being a teacher. And it comes from having an abundance mentality, because the more good writers who are out there, the more readers they will reach. And by promoting my fellow writers, ultimately, I guess I reach more readers. But it's really just because I'm a terrible fangirl and I enjoy meeting other writers and talking about books, and I get really excited when I talk about the craft of books, so I'm a terrible nerd as well. Yeah, can't help it.
Switching gears a bit, your novel The Price of Fame was a break from the nail-biting political fantasy of the two trilogies. Can you give us a bit of background on that story, and how different was it for you taking on paranormal crime?
I think the core of The Price of Fame is still very similar to what I tend to write without meaning to, which is an exploration of gender and identity and power. So what you have in The Price of Fame is there's a section of it set in St Kilda in the late 70s, early 80s, and it deals with prostitution and crime and drug running and the street kids and how desperate they are. And you've also got a modern section because it runs on two timelines. But that also deals with power and how people try and wield power over others. So it is about gender and power and violence again. And it's funny because, it's funny you should say it's a big change, because I wrote the 1980s section when I was 23, 24. And then I didn't send it out because I figured that I didn't have enough life experience to write something that was really worthwhile. So I put it away. And then when I was 36, after having six children in 10 years, I pulled it out and I read it and I thought, gee, it's not that bad. And I cleaned up a couple of sentences and sent it off to the Harper $10,000 fiction prize, and it made the long short list. So I figured that there was potential in the story, but I had to find a way to make it contemporary and interesting. And that was when I rewrote it with the second thread, where the contemporary story is somebody researching a death that happened in the past, and in doing so they uncover secrets which have been hidden for 30 years. So it really wasn't such a big change for me. And I find with interviewing authors that a lot of authors write, if they're writing fantasy or science fiction, they tend to also write historical or mystery. And I think this is because in fantasy and science fiction, you have the world building and the creation of a world. If you're writing historical, you have to do the research and you have to recreate that world to bring it to life for your readers. If you're writing mystery, then you have to create the world of the mystery, and what you reveal and when you reveal it is really important to sustaining tension. So those elements of world building are the same across all of those genres.
Your current fantasy series has been published by Solaris, who are a UK company. How has it been beneficial to be published overseas as opposed to being published locally?
The wonderful thing with Solaris is that they approached Clint Langley. He does a lot of artwork for Black Library, and he did the really beautiful covers for me for King Roland's Kin. And I think that definitely contributed towards the success of that series. And then when The Outcast Chronicles was coming out, they also approached him to produce the covers. I was happy to have a publisher based in the UK because I wanted distribution in the US and the UK. They're you know, the two biggest English-speaking markets. And the only thing I think that I'm missing is I don't get, my books don't get very good distribution in Australia, so that if people want them, they have to go into the bookstore and specifically order them. So I don't get the impulse buys, and they tend to be only in the specialist bookstores like Pulp Fiction in Brisbane and Galaxy Books in Sydney. So I probably miss out on sales. And I do go to events like Supernova so that I, you know, am meeting readers. And when I was in Supernova in Sydney last year, I sold a heap of books. And then just the other day I had a comment on Twitter, or it might have been on my blog, from someone saying, oh, I bought the first book of King Roland's Kin from in Sydney at Supernova, and then I went out and got the other three, and they were really good, and now I'm going to buy The Outcast Chronicle. And you really can't get past somebody liking your book enough to do that and to say to their friends, this is really good, you should read it. And so reaching out to readers is the best thing, and word of mouth is the absolute best promotion that a writer can have. So bringing that the full circle back to Solaris, if they hadn't done the really great covers for me, the books wouldn't have been picked up off the bookshelf. And so I owe them a lot, and they've been terrific.
Your book, The Price of Fame, is published by a local small press, Clandestine. You've mentioned before how The Price of Fame had a reasonably long gestation period. With your experience, you could conceivably have gone the self-publishing route. What dissuaded you from making that choice and going with the wonderful crew at Clandestine?
I didn't want to self-publish my standalone, I call it gritty crime noir, because it's very hard for a writer to be self-critical, or they can be so self-critical that they'll curl into a ball and disappear, or they can think that this is wonderful because you haven't got that sense of self-judgment. So when I heard that Lindy Cameron, who is herself an award-winning mystery thriller writer, was starting this independent press, I submitted to her, and when she read it and said she loved it, I felt, well, this is somebody who knows the genre really well. She's an award-winning author. She says the book is working, so I can trust her judgment on that. So that was why I went with them. But I do have the rights back for my original trilogy, and I'm in the process of reprinting that, because unless you're somebody like George R. Martin, your publishers are not going to reprint your backlist. So that's my husband has done some wonderful covers for it, and we've been applying online for our National Library catalogue listing this morning, so going through all the hard slog and the paperwork, but it's worth it in the long run.
Okay, I'm just going to have a momentary squee of delight at hearing that news. That's wonderful. We're coming towards the end of the questions I've got for you, so there's only a couple left. In 2001, along with Marianne DePierre, you founded RAW, or Writers on the Rise. Now, when I go and look over the members that are in that group, we have a very successful cadre of writers. And I'm wondering, was it something in the water at Mullaney, or is this just the result of the benefit of having a supportive group of skilled craftspeople?
I think it's the benefit of having a group of people who are passionate about the craft of writing. And when they give a critique on each other's books, they want that book to be the best it can possibly be. So as writers, we continue to grow and learn and develop. And when one of us has a success, like Margot Lanigan has won, I think it's 4 World Fantasy Awards for her work now, we all jump up and down and go, yay, Margot! And Tansy just won the Washington Science Fiction Small Press Award for one of her stories, and she also won it in 2010. And Richard's done really well, and Marianne's done really well, and I often feel like I'm the underachiever. But as writers, we find that we often have these fallow patches where become orphaned. And so you become orphaned by your publisher and orphaned by your agent, and you're not out there selling books. But that doesn't mean that you're not developing and growing as a writer. And then as long as you keep working and keep submitting, the wheels grind around again and you get picked up by a publisher. And if you're like me, you have that backlog of books that you've written that are just about ready to go off. So there are benefits to having that period where you're lying fallow, just as it's very challenging to be writing to constant deadlines, as Marianne has been doing for the last few years and as I'm doing now, because I'm writing King Roland's King 4, which has to be handed in May. And I'm finding between my teaching and the renovating and chasing my teenage and adult kids all over the place, it's very hard to write that first draft. You have to be in the story. You've got to be in the zone to write it. And when you get the constant interruptions, it's really hard to get back into the right frame of mind. So I get this temptation to just run away somewhere and write. And I have this daydream where I'm somewhere like on the west coast of Tasmania, and I'm hiding and I'm just writing all day long, and I see it as a kind of heaven. I think I'd miss my family terribly, but at least with the internet, I could do things like this. I could chat to my writing friends. And yes, the temptation to run away to write is very strong.
Okay. Well, you've touched on a few things that I was going to ask in the last question here. So you're doing a book 4 of King Roland's Kin, which, again, I'm overjoyed at. You've got your rights back for your first trilogy. So is the plan to just continue, you know, gradually working through the books that you've got banked up, or are you going to actually take some time off, or is the compulsion to write that strong that you can't see yourself ever stop doing it?
The compulsion to write is very strong, Sean. And I will probably be writing basically new books, because my publisher only wants what they call traditional fantasy. So that ranges, from what I can gather, from King Roland's Kin, which is more of a traditional fantasy. I think of it as a boy's own adventure fantasy, to The Outcast Chronicles, which I see as a political power fantasy. But I have also got a dangerous tropical fantasy, which is written, but my publisher doesn't want, because I think they have trouble imagining fantasy happening in a tropical setting. So I have a couple of other things written which I don't have a real market for, and I may, in between writing and delivering books to my publisher, review and may release them myself. But all of that it depends on whether I can survive by not teaching anymore, and how many of my children are still living at home, and whether we can live on my earnings and my husband's superannuation. So there's so many factors beyond my control. But the one factor that isn't beyond my control is just sitting down and writing. And that's intrinsically satisfying in itself. And when a scene goes really well, I get this little thrill of delight. So, yes, it's like I've given myself a little present, because I think, oh, this is really working. And I can see how the whole book's hanging together. And yes, so you're right. The writing is a passion which I think if you're a writer, you just write.
Okay, I think that was a beautiful answer, and I can see in the passion you're delivering in that answer, it comes through in the books. I've just finished Exile this morning, and I can only remember perhaps a small group of books where I put a book down and go, you know, I just simply must read more of this. You know, that's the type of passionate writing that really draws me in and can enable me to forget anything else that's going on around me. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Rowena. I want to thank you for the opportunity and wish you the best of luck. I will be eagerly awaiting whatever you decide to write.
Thank you very much, Sean. And maybe I will run away to the west coast of Tasmania and hide somewhere and do nothing but writing. We'll see. Thanks, Sean.